This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello and welcome back to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Bill McCush. This week, a local artist tells his story on how he discovered a unique brand of art, fusing new techniques and historic ones. A youth project in Sydney opened its doors to the public where young people can discuss important matters in a safe environment. Some City Hall news as the CBRM moves on to business after their recent swearing-in ceremony at Centre 200. And we'll hear from a local veteran on the season of Remembrance Day and how he decided to join the wartime effort at less than 15 years old. These stories are coming up on the Coast. Eric McKeegan of Lewisburg lives with spina bifida, but it doesn't hamper his work ethic in creating a unique brand of handcrafted pens, accessories, and countless other pieces of art. His products are intricately designed using resin, historic hand tools, and modern machinery for a process called wood fretting. That's why Eric named his company Fretwood Mac. He likes their music, but it has nothing to do with the popular band. He looks for every opportunity to showcase his work at exhibitions, markets, and even online. Eric's story is as intriguing as his art, and he begins by telling Dialogue's Cora Perrigo. His unique approach to wood fretting was discovered by accident.
For as long as I've been doing this, the hardest thing for me to do is describe what it is I do. Nothing in my life has ever been simple. Like, I don't know if it's manifestation in my work that, you know, I have to find the complicated way of doing things, or if I just find complicated things to do. The scroll saw stuff, I've been doing that 32 years. You know, I really only started incorporating resin like 8 years ago. That was because I broke something, pretty elaborate piece, and I was like, I worked this far. I need to find a way to fix it. And then from there, it just was like, well, now I have lots of resin left over, and it was expensive, so I need to find a way to use it. So then I just started using it in everything. Yeah, it just kind of, you know, grew from there. With the products that I make, I consciously try to make things that are both practical but decorative. I would rather buy something that is not just useful, but, you know, serves some other purpose. What that is, it could be any number of things. Something that serves a purpose, but while you're not using it, if you have friends over or whatever the case is, you can leave it on the counter or on the coffee table or whatever, and it just serves as a conversation piece, because someone else is going to look at it and say, you know, either what is that, mm-hmm. or what is it made from? Like, even when I first started this iteration of business called Fretwood Mac, my first 3 months in business, I actually gave all of my sales money away. When I first started, it was the end of October going into November. And so everybody was doing the Movember mustache thing. So I started making little wooden mustaches, and I had a couple of other friends who had established businesses that were more female oriented, but, you know, wanted to play with the idea of having these, you know, wooden mustaches in their businesses.
Yeah.
So they allowed me to make them for them to sell. I didn't keep any of that money. They didn't keep any of that money. It all went to a local hospital cancer research. I had a friend that I'd known for, let's say, 15 years, probably longer, was a mother of three kids. The youngest one had been diagnosed with leukemia. And so the child was in the hospital 24/7, which meant she went and essentially lived at the hospital because he was only 2 or 3 years old at the time. Long story short, she went into super mom mode, didn't sleep for 4 or 5 days. That she also didn't eat. So not eating, not sleeping for an extended period of time put her into a coma herself. She ended up passing away. The child recovered and is still, you know, cancer-free now. And so I, because that was the end of November-ish, I was making Christmas ornaments. I was planning to make Christmas ornaments already. So the Christmas ornaments that I made, I donated all that money to that family because now her husband was left with, you know, multiple children and, you know, half the income that they were used to. And now they were going to have, you know, burial expenses and, you know, on top of, you know, at the time they were still going to have medical expenses. And so I gave all that money away. And then the local SPCA was doing a Christmas fundraiser also. So I jumped on board with them and was making paw print ornaments. And I gave all that money to them. So it, for the first 3 months I was in business, I did three fundraisers. Like, I lost money because I was buying the materials and gave them all my profits. There were people that saw, you know, what I was doing and could appreciate what I was doing. And yes, that did lead to sales that I probably wouldn't have gotten otherwise because I was reaching someone else's customer base. So had I just, you know, started making things to sell right away and approaching people that I knew, that would have been one thing. But because I reached out through other networks, it certainly expanded, you know, my reach. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Customer satisfaction for me is more important than volume of sales. The sales will come if the customers are happy.
Yeah, how did you get started in it?
So my dad was a carpenter when I was a kid, and he built tables and chairs and, you know, all the things that you would typically think of when you think woodworking. And so I would sit in the workshop and I would do all the things that a little kid was allowed to do in the workshop. So typically that meant sanding things. I mean, I was having fun because I was a little kid and I was, you know, in the shop with my dad. So that's how I got started in woodworking in general. And then fast forward, you know, my personal history, I was born with spina bifida. I had a hip surgery at 11 years old that caused me to be bedridden for an extended period of time. I was assigned an occupational therapist. She took me to several things that weren't young boy interesting. So like cooking class, there was sewing and a lot of, like I said, a lot of things that weren't interesting to an 11-year-old boy. One day she took me to an older gentleman who had just a brick building in the middle of nowhere. He had a wood shop set up in this brick building, and then he had an RV trailer that was full of the wooden things that he made. And none of them were tables. None of them were chairs. None of them were functional pieces at all. They were all scroll saw projects. I went to see him 2 or 3 weeks with her. And then, you know, being an arrogant little 11-year-old boy, decided that I had learned enough that I could do it.
I've seen this for 5 minutes. Yeah, I can do this.
Exactly. And so after 3, you know, maybe 4 weeks, I said, all right, I don't need to go back to him, and you've done your job. You know, I've reacclimated to society after bed rest. And so my parents purchased my first scroll saw, which wasn't a very good one. It was a Sears Craftsman. You know, it had a sanding disc on the back. Before long, I had sanded the power cord in half. Design flaw was that the power cord came out of the back of the machine over top of the sanding disc. And there was no way to turn off the sanding disc independent of the saw. So once you turn the saw on, sanding disc flies. That was my first saw, and my dad was making garden boxes, and so I would make little flowers or, you know, cartoon figures and put them on the flower boxes. He would sell flower box for, you know, at that time they were maybe $25, and we added an extra couple or $5 for what I did, and I got some of that money. So that's how it started. Very simple, you know, oftentimes just silhouette projects. I would just, you know, do more elaborate things for a child at the time. And then fast forward a bunch of years to my first iteration of a woodworking business of my own. Was a business I called Wood and Wheels. I bought an old school bus and I took all the seats out and I installed a full woodworking shop in the school bus. And the idea was to have the bus licensed to be on the road so that I could actually drive up to your house and custom fit things. Spoiler alert, to do that, your first stop should be the insurance company, because they will tell you that to insure a rolling wood or to insure a wood shop is expensive. To insure a wood shop on wheels that's going to like go places is so expensive that you don't want to do it. So I ended up just parking the bus and working from one location. So I ran that for a few years. And then it was time to quote unquote get a real job. So I tried that and I did that. I was in and out of jobs for a number of reasons. I would pick seasonal jobs or I would pick contract jobs. That first business, Wooden Wheels, started in 2003. My second woodworking business, which is now Fretwood Mac, started in 2013. Prior to that, had gotten a job as an ambulance dispatcher. I thought I was set. I was now going to make more money than I needed to. I didn't have to do woodworking, you know, as a moneymaker anymore. So I got the job in February of 2013 as an ambulance dispatcher. And 3 months later, I started the job. 2 weeks after I started the job, I was at work as an ambulance dispatcher, taking phone calls, and I was still in training, and I looked at my trainer, and I said, I don't feel well, and so I wrote it out for a little bit, but then I eventually ended up going home 9 hours into a 12-hour shift, came back the next night, and I went home 3 hours into a 12-hour shift. The third night, less than 3 hours in, I called an ambulance to my own desk, for which we had to explain to the dispatcher it wasn't a training exercise. Inform the dispatcher, yes, this is a real call. Please send an ambulance. The ambulance came to get me, took me to the hospital, and I had some tests done. They let me go. I took a cab back to my work and then drove home, which was about, I don't know, 40-minute drive. Then I got a call from the doctor the next day saying that I had to have what they called emergency brain surgery, but it wasn't immediate. I was having emergency brain surgery in 3 days. 3 days go by, I go in and I have, related to my spina bifida, I have another condition called hydrocephalus, which your brain is surrounded by fluid that causes or keeps it from slamming into your skull. Naturally, it's supposed to drain through your spinal column. Mine is blocked. And so they've installed a plastic tube called a shunt. The shunt that I had at the time collapsed. And so the fluid wasn't draining. And the reason I didn't feel well is because my head was starting to swell, which is why I had to have quote-unquote emergency brain surgery, because they needed to go in and either fix or install a new shunt, which is what they did. They put in a brand new one. It was supposed to be, what did they say? It was supposed to be a 90-minute procedure. After 90 minutes, they came out to the people in the waiting room and said, we're just getting started and things aren't what we expected. It's a bit of a war zone inside his head. There was a lot of scar tissue buildup because turns out they don't actually know when the tube collapsed.
Oh.
And it could have been those 3 days that I felt bad, or it could have been 5 or 10 years. They have no idea. But what was starting to happen was there was scar tissue where the tube used to be, and the fluid was attempting to drain through the scar tissue, but was being blocked because of how much was built up. 90 minutes in, they come out and say, yep, we're just getting started. The procedure ended up being 6.5 hours. I was then discharged the next day. And so that was from February. I got the job. May, I had the surgery. Was off on medical leave. But because that happened during my probation period of my job, my employer decided not to retain my services. And my contract is not renewed. I'm in sports terms, I'm future endeavored. So they wrote me this, pleasantly worded letter saying, we were glad to have you when we had you. If and when things get better for you, feel free to reapply. And we wish you well in your future endeavors. The welcome back never happened. Reapplying to positions in that field, it's a provincial job, and so even if you move districts or counties, they're all interconnected through the province, and so reference checks happen. So that really has been an ongoing battle that I did and still do have when I choose to try to get back into that field. And so as a result of losing that job, at the time I was newly married, one income, her income in retail, wasn't going to sustain a household. So Fretwood Mac became kind of more than a necessity at that time. That's how it got established as my next iteration. So yeah, that is kind of the progression. Got the job in February, had brain surgery in May, lost the job in November, and knew that I couldn't go back, that I needed to do something. And it was something that I could do at my own pace, on my own terms, and not have somebody tell me I was doing it wrong, or I wasn't doing it fast enough, I wasn't, whatever the critique was, whatever the feedback was all mine.
Mayor Cecil Clark and the CBRM's 12 counselors were ushered into the swearing-in ceremony to the familiar Cape Breton sounds of drums and bagpipes. About 200 people attended the event to hear Clark's first official speech as mayor. He spoke about council priorities for the next four-year term. He said those priorities include curbing racism.
Our service has to rise above ourselves to serve the citizens of our community. At a time where we see great opportunity and growth, yet we're impacted by challenges that face us on a daily basis. And some of those challenges, quite frankly, are despicable. And we have to face things like racism head on. We cannot allow hate to exist or persist in our world, and we have to call it out.
Later, Clark spoke with reporters to follow up on council's concerns about intolerance in the community. Clark says some people are reaching out to him personally for support.
I understand the volatility in the world right now, and that people feel they can say anything without consequence. That's just not the case. And people taking something the way they might have thought it was funny, it was far from funny. And at the same time, for me to have people writing to me asking me to help them from racism because they feel attacked and threatened in the community as newcomers here, I will address those issues. I'm responding to individuals that are pleading for help, and especially individuals that have come here from away that just feel that they have no recourse or where to go. So this is going to be a very serious discussion with our police officials, but also it's all citizens aspect.
Clark was asked if the focus on racism has anything to do with a weekend Halloween party at a local fire hall. A few people showed up wearing KKK costumes, resulting in a social media backlash condemning the act. Clark responds by saying racism in general is cause for concern in the community, not to mention he personally has been the victim of hateful comments because of his same-sex marriage.
It was going to be a point by virtue of I made commitments with people that reached out to me during the campaign about their fears around what was happening on the streets and people being harassed, and I've witnessed it myself, of people being verbally assaulted and said, quite frankly, heinous things to them. And to have a senior citizen on the Esplanade come to me after I knocked on the door and start talking about how she just gets upset, how people in the building would talk about my being gay or queer and that and talking about black people in a very derogatory way, this has to be addressed. It's an all-ages issue, and it's not acceptable in our community, and I think we need to send a very clear message that we are a welcoming community, we are a community that includes all, and we will not tolerate this. We're in a world right now that feels that words don't have consequence. Well, there will have consequences in the CBRM.
Clark says homophobic slurs shouldn't be tolerated either, and that he was targeted while campaigning during the recent municipal election.
I've come through, like I say, the previous election, and I'm used to putting up with crap from people throwing homophobic crap my way. I don't have to tolerate that, and I can speak it out. And as I said, the silent majority has got to gain a voice, and this community's got to say that we're here for everyone to be welcome, safe, and we're accessible, and we're going to be a pride of place community, not one of fear.
Clark says he wants the community on board with their efforts, and council will work with the police to figure out what the consequences should be for people who attack someone's sexual orientation or ethnicity. Meanwhile, Clark says council has other priorities for the upcoming four-year term, such as getting more people involved with local government. Voter turnout is down in the recent election, and Clark says that means council needs a better connection with the community and more positive interactions.
Look, whenever you have lower voter turnout, you could almost feel it in terms of going around, knocking on doors. You get a sense that there was almost a certain apathy and there was a certain frustration. There's angst in our community. And so from the point of view of over 10,000 less people voting this time, statistically, it's a question to ask because the clerk's office, in fairness, all of the information went out a good in terms of letters with pins, where to vote, how to vote. It was a great ease to be able to vote. So the fact that people didn't, that's something I think that Mayor, Council, and the CBRM as a whole have to engage more. We have to be telling people how important these issues are. And maybe there's a level of what we have to do is just to get, when I say get back to basics, get back to informing people about things that matter to them on a daily basis and prove value by being there and out in the community as I plan to be.
Voter turnout was 48.3% in the recent election compared to 2020's 51.3%. The Cape Breton Youth Project in Sydney is a safe place for young people to discuss sexual orientation and gender identity. They recently held an open house as an opportunity to promote their services at their new home at the Eldwig Arts Centre in the North End. Dialogue's Cora Perrigo was there and caught up with the organization's director, Madonna Doucette.
What do you want people to know about the Youth Project?
I really want them to come in and see what's behind our doors. I know there's a lot of curiosity as to the services and resources that we offer. I'm really excited for the community to come and see all the different ways that we are, you know, supporting kids in need and also providing them with opportunity to be joyous and happy and safe. So I'm really proud to be able to showcase what we've created here.
And who can utilize the space?
Well, this our nonprofit is dedicated to youth 25 and under, to LGBTQ plus youth, but also their allies, their siblings. And honestly, there's no questionnaire to come in and access our space. So we have drop-ins every Tuesday and Wednesday where we offer like a free hot meal to the youth that show up. And whoever shows up, we feed. There's no agenda behind feeding people. So really, it's really actually the only youth space dedicated in downtown Sydney. So when you think about that, we're here for all youth.
And I've seen some posters around about how to access the Youth Project, how to get there. What would you say to a young person trying to access the resources at the Youth Project?
Well, as a lot of people know, Cape Breton still runs on Facebook. So reaching out through our social media page on Facebook or Instagram is probably the fastest route for a young person. We are located in the north end of George Street, so the buses stop nearby. But honestly, transportation is the biggest challenge for kids accessing our services. I'm so proud of the kids that make it here for the drop-ins, but I know that there are countless kids from New Waterford or Glace Bay or North Sydney that would also feel quite rejuvenated if they were able to come here, but there's a lot of barriers for them to access the space.
Do the children looking to access the space or the youth looking to access the space, would they require a parent's permission?
Youth 12 and older are welcome to be here, but for the most part, they're solidly teenagers that come here. And the same with young adults, they're welcome to come here, but our drop-ins tend to be for middle school and high school students. But one of my coworkers, Kaisen Williams, is also developing sober space for young adults. So that's meant for 18 to 30-year-olds, actually. So there's like a poetry slam that's going to happen in the near future. And we think it's important to role model sober space for queer young adults because of societal pitfalls of being queer in our community lead us sometimes down that pathway, and we want to show young people right out of the gate that you can be yourself. You don't need to be all juiced up on something in order to be your wonderful queer self, and that you can be like that here, and no one's going to pressure you to consume anything.
It's definitely refreshing because there's so many spaces, that are centered around alcohol or around romance or around specifically queer spaces that focus on those kinds of things. So it's nice to have somewhere that people, especially youth, trying to kind of enter into that community, have a space to go where it's not expected that they are going after those two things.
I would like to think that we are a gateway to sobriety.
Is there anything else you'd like the community to know, or anything you want youth to know about where you said the Sober Spaces Project, any other projects upcoming?
I think it's important for people to know that our primary mandate is to provide education and support resources for youth in schools. So if anyone wants a visit by the Youth Project to a school, they can reach out to us via social media and book us to come in, because, you know, learning about our differences and celebrating that diversity is a form of harm reduction. And we want people to skip the stage where they hate themselves and just jump right into the stage where they accept who they are.
This was a record-breaking year for the Port of Sydney's cruise ship season. 117 ships and 210,000 passengers visited this year, more than any other season. CKOA Radio spoke to cruise manager Nicole McCauley. She says traffic has been on the rise since the industry was sidelined for the 2020 season because of COVID-19. McCauley says, however, they didn't expect so soon to exceed the pre-pandemic average of 100 ships and 154,000 passengers per year.
I'm surprised and delighted this year that we are seeing those numbers. So we're seeing vessels coming in quite full. We're seeing some larger vessels coming in. And I don't think anyone would have predicted in the times of COVID that cruise would have resumed so well. And we're really happy to see these numbers.
McCauley credits a broad new marketing campaign involving other ports for the cruise ship traffic increase.
We are part of what is called the Atlantic Canada Cruise Association. So I work really closely with the other four partner ports in Atlantic Canada. So that's Halifax, St. John, New Brunswick, Charlottetown, PEI, and Corner Brook in Newfoundland and Labrador. And we all work collectively under a marketing body. So and then second to that, we are, as an association, a part of what we call the Canada New England Alliance. So that is made up of additional partners in Boston, New York, Maine, and the nine ports in the St. Lawrence. So we're really known as the destination is Canada, New England. So it makes it really easy for the cruise lines and for cruise passengers to find us. So we spend a lot of our marketing efforts as an alliance together.
McCauley says the campaign describes Cape Breton as a destination with attractive fall colors, good weather, and accessible shops in the downtown area near the port. CKOA Radio spoke to some passengers in the later part of the cruise season to see what they think about the area.
We love Sydney. This is our second time because we did the same cruise going the other direction a week ago, and we're certainly going back into town.
Beautiful weather since we've been here, so that's always good, isn't it? Yeah, and we've got the autumn colors.
We're from Western Pennsylvania, so we see a lot of deciduous trees and fall colors. So our travel agent had said, don't expect to see fall like you know it, but it's been beautiful. Everything, everyone is so friendly.
All the people in all the stores that we went in and all your local merchandise and all the things, the local stuff that the people make, very interesting.
Speaking of the local shops and businesses, Cape Breton Regional Chamber of Commerce CEO Megan Penny says business owners had to adjust in order to welcome more patrons when the vessels were in town.
Some of the businesses and restaurants down around the area here in town definitely staff up more for ship days coming in, you know, whether it's having more servers at the restaurant or a couple more people behind the desks at the shops. It's just an opportunity for them to grow their businesses in response to that. Destination Cape Breton works very closely with the port, and even for ourselves, you know, in other areas of the world and the United States specifically, chambers of commerce are often travel bureaus for their area. So it's just having that willingness to be accommodating. So when people pick up the phone and they call us with tourism-related questions, or they stop by when they're here on the ships, that we're able to point them in the right direction and give them the phone numbers for, say, Destination Cape Breton, or refer them to where they might be able to get some maps and some things that they might be able to do around the town.
Although 2024 broke the record for the most ships and passengers, this year was also a first for welcoming four ships in one day. McCauley says they're considering expanding the season next year to avoid congestion as the port becomes a more popular destination.
So one of the things that we're focused on as a region is really expanding that season. So we run into some congestion issues when we have multiple ships in port, or perhaps two really large ships in port, and it does put some pressure on our operators, our bus suppliers, all of those pieces that make the cruise world spin. I think one of the things that we have an opportunity to do is to work with the cruise lines. I think preparing for that expansion of the season and how we can all work together and create opportunities for passengers and all visitors to experience, no matter when they come to our island.
The season started in early April and ended Saturday with the departure of the season's smallest vessel, Insignia, accommodating 824 passengers at 180 meters in length, the Queen Mary II at 345 meters, carrying 2,700 passengers, was the largest this year. Cape Breton Regional Municipality has a new deputy mayor. Veteran councillor Elda McDonald was nominated uncontested during council's first official gathering since last month's municipal election.
Are there any other nominations? For second time, are there any other nominations for deputy mayor? For third and final time, are there any other nominations for the deputy mayor? There being none, congratulations, councillor Elda McDonald.
That was Mayor Cecil Clark giving the nod to McDonald. McDonald will continue to represent his District 5 constituents of the past 12 years while carrying out the duties of Deputy Mayor. He explains some of those duties to CKOA Radio.
Yeah, so Deputy Mayor very much is someone that fills in for the mayor. So there's different events, functions, meetings, whether it be board meetings that I may chair, committee meetings, could be council meetings in the absence of the mayor. So various different types of duties, functions, and events that the mayor, of course, would be invited to many functions and events. And sometimes there's duplication and would need someone to assist with those duties. So I'm more happy to help with that.
A mix of returning and new councillors were ushered into City Hall after last month's municipal election. McDonald says he will take a leadership role in helping them gel together to work as a team.
Yeah, we'll have to take some time to have some opportunities for us to come together as a council and to, as they say, it's good opportunities when we go to conferences and events and functions, whether that be local or off-island. But networking with yourself is important. And when you have a brand-new council and the councillors that are newly elected, we need to get to know each other and to network with each other so we can build a solid team there. And I've had conversations with all the councillors, look forward to working with them going forward and building that team effort there.
McDonald says approving a provincial audit of the CBRM's finances is among the top priorities. He says the Nova Scotia government will basically review the municipality's financial practices, then give it a report card and suggestions in targeting deficiencies. He says this resource will help them find ways of reducing unnecessary spending.
I welcome it. I think it's great. I look forward to working with the Premier and his staff and the various departments that would be involved in that and the consulting firm that will be chosen by the province to carry out that audit. It's a good thing for our municipality. There's always efficiencies, as I said, you can find. We need to find a path forward for sustainability. And it's my hope and my goal that we work with all levels of government to be able to achieve those outcomes, because a solid, sustainable CBRM makes for a better, solid Nova Scotia.
McDonald says council is promoting the audit to the public as receiving a helping hand rather than handing over the keys to the province.
We're looking at the province to say that we believe we're as sustainable as we can. If you find deficiencies with budgets, with people wanting lower taxes but yet wanting more services or maintain services, revenue has to be there to be able to maintain services. So this is about not handing over any autonomy. It's about looking at the actual stability of our municipality financially and where we can achieve positive outcomes to make that sustainability even better. And the province should be there as a partner in that because, again, a stronger CBRM makes a stronger Nova Scotia, and that should be important to all levels of government.
McDonald will also be council's liaison for discussions involving police and fire services. His term as deputy mayor will run for 1 year. Thank you. For Remembrance Day, a look back on an interview Coast Radio did with a local veteran. 96-year-old George Cann of Sydney was in the Merchant Navy. During the Second World War, they delivered crucial supplies to the Allied forces, and they were targets for the enemy in the North Atlantic. Cann was inspired by his siblings, who also contributed to the wartime effort. He was only 14 years old when he signed up. He said he was just a kid in school looking out the window, and he was more interested in fighting the Germans than arithmetic.
The bureau went to school, Whitney School, and I was able to look out through the classroom windows down at the docks where all the ships were, and I had to be on one of them ships. I tried to join the Navy on several occasions and was turned down because of my age. And the reason why I was wanting, part of the reason why I was wanting to get in there was my brother, older brother and older sister were both in the service, and I thought I should follow their example.
Mr. Cann says he had a hard time adjusting at his age when he was working on the ships. He didn't like being told what to do, but eventually he got with the program.
At my age, it was damn hard work. It was hard to take orders. So learned that I had to do that. After I got by that, I got along pretty good with the older fellows. I think everybody was a friend because one depended on the other for our welfare. And getting aboard the ship and getting settled in and getting the instructions on what you were required to do, had to do, it was pretty intense. The few times you went in the corner and kind of sniffled a little bit about it and then put your head down and got back to work.
Cann says, looking back, peaceful moments on board were few and far between because of the anxiety thinking about the predators armed with torpedoes beneath the sea. He says there were many horrific moments, and he talks about an incident that hits close to home. An American crew was turned to charcoal after their ship was rammed by another. Cann says it's hard to imagine the remains were later shoveled into garbage cans.
I don't know if I had brain loss to be concerned for myself, but action stations and all that stuff, common stuff in convoys. But the most horrific thing that I can speak about or think about it happened right here, right in Sydney Harbor, where an American ship was in a convoy off of Newfoundland in a very thick fog, and it was rammed by a tanker. And it was coated with gasoline from stem to stern, and it was a fire, bad fire, had ammunition and whatnot for cargo. The paint was burnt right off it completely. A lot of small metal was melted and all that sort of thing. The crew mostly was turned to charcoal, I think I said that. And the Navy got it out of the convoy and towed it out almost to Sydney. And we went out and towed her into the Northwest Arm here and put her head aground. And she was there for about a week, biffing and banging with manganese and so on. And finally, somebody decided that they should wait till low tide and cut sluts in the side of the hull. And when the tide came back up, the water rushed into the ship and put out the fire. The bodies were taken up to Hardwood Hill here, and that's pretty much what happened there. Hard to believe that you shovel bodies into garbage cans and take them to the grave.
Cann worked on more than a dozen ships during his naval career. After the war, he was grateful to return to Cape Breton in one piece, although he often thinks of his crewmates who weren't so lucky. None of the vessels he worked on were destroyed by German U-boats, although there was a close call during a mission in the Irish Sea.
Every not too clear on it anymore, kind of forget, but what happened is our ships, some of our newer ships were equipped with torpedoes, and that's which they could put over the side and catch torpedoes before they would hit the ship. As the story goes, as I remember it, we went into a port called Falmouth in England, where they were equipped to do this kind of work. And they cleaned us up and put the torpedo nets back up where they belonged on the ship. And we proceeded on up to Liverpool, up Manchester Ship Canal, to Manchester, where we discharged our wartime cargo.
If you ask Mr. Can if he has any regrets about signing up for the Merchant Marines at the young age of 14, certainly from what you've heard so far, his reply won't surprise you.
Oh, no, none whatsoever. What I'll say is when you're 14 years old, yeah, you're pretty cocky, aren't you? And you think you can do anything. I met my brother when he was overseas in England in training in the tank corps, and we had a little bit of a party between us, and it was back to the ship, back to Canada. He went on to fight the war, and where he got caught up to was in the Filet Gap, in I believe that's Belgium or France. In the tank corps, got wounded really bad, but he did survive.
As you heard Mr. Can say earlier, Sydney Harbour played an important role during the Second World War. On the boardwalk downtown at the waterfront, you'll find a very lifelike monument dedicated to the merchant mariners. Sydney Harbour was once home to a Royal Canadian Navy base, HMCS Protector. It was established to stage supply convoys bound for Europe. Those convoys tended to be slower, and they had the prefix SC, for slow convoy. Convoy SC-7 knew of the dangers with the Nazi U-boats off the coast of Cape Breton and Newfoundland during the Battle of the Atlantic, when 20 of the 30 merchant cargo vessels were sunk on their journey to England. That's all for Dialogue this week. If you have an idea for a segment on the program, call the newsroom at 902-284-6397 or send an email at news@coastalradio.ca. Thanks for listening. I'm Bill McCush.